Session number 16712, Albert Saturated Rail 8.
Saturated Rail 8. We're talking about patrolling, Mr. Scatcherd, in Tobruk. And you said that you went on several of those patrols. Reconnaissance patrol was to, what was its task, really?
Was to gain information as to the position of the enemy. So that later on, if there was an attack going to be made, we knew exactly where to go to.
So you'd have to get very close.
Yeah. Oh, yes, you got pretty close to them. But when you got a little bit too close and they heard anything, all you got back was a burst of fire from the Spandau gun. They had a Spandau gun then. And the Spandau was a quick-firing gun that was twice as fast as a Bren gun. A Bren gun, compared to them, they were going put, but a Spandau went brr, you know. And in fact, the Italian Beretta was quicker than what our Bren gun was.
Did you feel there were better weapons than the Bren?
Oh, the Spandau was yes, definitely. The Bren was a good gun, but the trouble was it was too accurate. Because when the Bren gun fired, all your bullets would be within a certain circle. Now, the Lewis gun was a better gun, but in respect, because it used to have a spreading fire. It used to spread out more.
You said that if you were discovered or heard, they would fire at you. Did they try to light you up with very light or something?
Oh, yes. You got to know when you'd been discovered, because their Bailey lights went up and they were brilliant white lights. And they used to light the whole area up. And Juries used to fire them up. And they used to come down on a small parachute. And really light the whole area up. And you daren't bat your eye. You daren't move.
So that was the drill. You froze.
Oh, we'd known about that, man, because we'd be trained for all this.
Did you go on any other types of patrol? You mentioned fighting patrols. Did you ever go out on any of those?
I was never out on a fighting patrol. No, I didn't go on a fighting patrol. No.
What would be the objective of a fighting patrol?
Well, a fighting patrol will go out with the object of trying to get a prisoner for information purposes. That was the main reason for fighting patrol. Yeah.
Did the Germans patrol as actively as the British?
Yes. We've got one or two Germans that were actually on patrol, brought them back, and of course we got information as much as we could, like the officers. They got as much information as they could out of them, but I suppose it'd be like our side, they wouldn't give very much apart from rank, name and number.
So you did patrolling, and you mentioned the minefields that you sometimes worked in. Were you back at B Echelon or wherever in this situation, or were you in the front line with the rest of the...
Oh, we're up until the second line, and very often in the front line. And then, but mostly our work was occupied at the back, preparing mines and putting the primers in grenades and things like that.
That must have been a pretty ticklish job.
Oh, aye.
How is it done? How do you prime a hand grenade?
Well, you just take the cap off the bottom, and with two wires inside, and you've got your fuse. You push your fuse in very carefully, connect it to two wires, and screw the cap back on again. Now, as soon as the pin was pulled out. It was a spring loader. It's a spring out, and the grenade was alive then. But you used to throw it immediately. Count seven, and you knew. You had to get your head down before you counted about five. At seven, it opened to go. By then, it was about 20 or 30 yards away, like.
And part of your work was to prime these, as you say.
Yeah.
And presumably pass them through to the troops in front.
Yes. Iron boxes. They're all put into boxes and already primed. Yeah.
You mentioned doing something with mines. What did you do with mines? How did you prime them?
Well, the mines, the corporal used to do that. We used to go and put them out very, very gently, carefully. They used to be already primed. Put them in the ground. We used to have the lid off them. We used to put the fuse in and set it. Put the lid back on again and very lightly just brush it over with the sand. And a compass bearing was taken and from one point on each mine. And we had the sand major had a big piece of paper and he pinpointed every mine that was laid. So that later on we could go and just pick each mine up just as you wanted.
How far apart would you lay the mines?
Oh, they were put, they weren't put in uniform style. They were just jutted about here, there, and all over the place. There was no uniformity about them. But that was the beauty of it. Because if they found one place through, they could just march straight through any of them. But if you put it here and there, you didn't know whether to put your foot left, right, or centre. You'd be on a mine. But when it was known exactly where they were, well, you knew exactly where to avoid. And we used to have a ribbon through where our own troops could march, go through safely through a minefield, you see. Well, when you got it to a German minefield, it was a case of getting down on your knees and just feeling your way forward with your bayonet and just scraping into the sand and just going forward. They found a mine and then you got the pattern of them. They had them.
And you were able to deal with them?
Yeah.
And was that taught to you by using German mines that you'd taken?
No, our engineers already knew this. But the Germans they had a method of had a white dot on and a red dot. Now, white was safe and red was danger, but they used to switch the fuses around. So the red danger was on white. So you didn't know whether you were dealing with a safe mine or not. You didn't know which way to turn them. More by looking at him, well, the engineers had a device of some sort and they could tell exactly what they were like.
So you had German minefields to deal with, and was their positions wired in with barbed wire?
Oh, yes, they were all the fortifications behind the front lines were all barbed wire, each side.
When we talk about barbed wire, you can imagine lengths of wire, but what kind of height and depth?
It was torpedo wire, and you used to have about three bundles of circular wire. You'd have the two on the bottom and one on the top, and then you'd have your posts out in front of that, barbed wire stretched out along there.
And what height might they be from the ground?
Used to be about 3 or 4 foot, maybe up to about 5 foot.
And did the Germans use a similar style?
Almost a similar pattern of reinforcement, anyway. There's a heat going up.
Supplies into Tobruk were not too great, were they? Were intermittent. What was the food situation like?
Well, we were supplied by sea. And mostly it was mostly bully beef and hardtack biscuits. But it was marvellous what the cooks could do with bully beef. We used to get a few potatoes in and make tatty ash. We would fry it, boil it. Mostly it was burnt. And the water situation, well, that was the worst, because the engineers, we were getting the water in, sea water, and they had something rigged up there. They used to take all the brackish taste out of the sea water. How they did, I don't know, but we used to get barrels of that, 44-gallon drums of that, and you were allowed a water bottle a day. And mind, when you got a drink of that, mind do, you could drink another one, because it was so salty, really brackish. We got so used to it, well, you didn't care about it anymore.
And with your water bottle, you would what, wash and drink?
Oh, yes, the same water. You had to. What we used to do is cut a petrol tin in half. Of course, they were nearly all petrol tins then, it was all supplied for the tanks and that. And we used to keep them, cut them in half, and of course, this is a. You couldn't do this right in the front line. You had to do that when you got your respirator and you move back out to the front or second line, back into echelon, B echelon, and you're pretty safe there. And you could do all your washing and get yourself all cleaned up and everything, shaven and everything. Everything was done with cold water. And what we used to do was get a fire going, heat the water up, just throw all your khaki shorts and everything in, wash the whole lot together, hang it out, where you just used to spread it out on the sand, and it would dry in half an hour with the heat of the sun. And it's surprising, but at night, you see absolutely freezing. It's surprising to see that in the desert. And you used to get out, when we sleeping at night time, you used to get down in the sand, just dig a hole in the sand for your hips. You used to rest your pack, and you sail on the door. On your head and just lie down there. And of course, we had our great coats for us, which used to throw them over us, and that was it there till dawn the following morning. And you were straight up, mind, 4 o'clock in the morning, and you were on watch till 6.
That's stand two, was it?
Stand two, till 6 o'clock, aye.
So it was very cold at night. Yeah. What was it like during the day?
And then we used to play hell about the sun during the day, but by 6 o'clock in the morning we were working on the sun getting up.
Did you have problems with flies?
Oh, flies, there were millions.
How did you deal
with
them?
Well, we had no protection against them at all. In fact, we used to get a lot of desert sores off the sand. Now, we used to be issued with these paper bandages. Used to put them on over the desert sores. And anyway, there was a Yankee doctor there, come up one of the boats, and he got in charge of the medical supplies and everything. And he turned round and he said, "Right, everybody, no more bandaging desert sores up." And, oh, they used to be awful. Oh, dear me. Bloody flies used to get into them and biting them. He says, "There's no more of that." He says, "The flies will go and eat all the bad stuff out." He says, "They'll leave your flesh completely clean." And that's what we had to do. It was a bloody agony. So we just used to all the bandages away. And if you had a desert sore, man, these running sores, you know, really bad. And they're black with flies, big flies. And the flies out there were as big as the blue bottles in Oakland. And, boy, they were nipping in, nipping in. At the finish, you nearly driven mad with them. But anyway, when they'd finished and knocking them off, like, you could see the new flesh underneath. And you used to really heal up. He was right in what he said. Right.
It's been very difficult keeping your hands off them.
Oh, really, aye. Going on.
These sort of kind of poisoning, were they? Was it a pus or something that was coming out rotten?
Oh, there was, it was just like a gravel rash. You got a gravel rash on the tarmac road, it wasn't, you know, used to bleed and be rough and all that. Well, deserts also almost similar. But with the heat and the sand and that getting into them, it was a damn sight rougher.
Was it difficult eating and drinking with so many flies about you?
Not really, no. We couldn't do anything about it. There was nothing to protect you against them, really.
So you just have to shake them off your food?
That's all you could do. I mean, when you're eating, getting a bit of corned beef out of a tin, you used to be three of you to a tin of corned beef for the day, and about four hard biscuits apiece. And that was your ration for the day, like, until at night time. The cooks used to make a meal in the back line, bring it forward, and we should get a hot meal, like, you know, in the evening.
Did they actually bring it right forward, or did you have some carrying parties?
The carrying parties used to bring it all up in containers, in hot containers that kept them hot. Dish it all out to the different companies. And then we went straight back with them, like, you know, and come again next time. So it was the next night. But you've got to get a hot meal once a day.
It must have been difficult to keep quiet under those conditions. I presume these would be metal containers.
They were metal containers, but they were carried up, you know. They were carried forward. They weren't brought on a transport. They were carried up. Two men. Want to eat your handle.
So the evening meal we well look forward to.
Yes.
And this was some concoction that they made from the bully beef and the biscuits.
That's right. Potatoes, carrots, anything was thrown in. It was always welcome, that.
What did you do for latrines, toilets?
Latrines, just dig a place in the sand and that was it, domino. Just anywhere where, you stood.
You say that at some point you got relaxation, you were relieved and went out of the immediate line into the back areas. Whereabouts did you go? Was Tobruk perimeter wasn't very deep, was it?
No. Well, what used to happen was, we're into Tobruk all the time until the Germans came down, and then we got out of Tobruk about a month before the Tobruk fell. We were moved out, and we went back down the line, and went to El Kabrit from out of Tobruk, and Word had been there, we got to know, like, we were getting moved out, and that we were going to Malta. And we moved back to El Kabrit, and then we went from there to Alexandra. And from Alexandra, we did training there, and we moved over to Malta. And that was an entirely different proposition altogether.
Remember when this was?
Yes, I was about 1940, back in the 42, early 43. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you move across, obviously by ship, but did you move across by night?
We went over from Alexandra and we sailed at night time, and there was Admiral Vian. He was the man in charge of the escort, Admiral Vian. And we got within about 10 to 12 miles Malta and came under heavy bombardment then because the Germans was it was the peak of the bombing in Malta at that time. And anyway, we got through that, and it was we lost about 4 to 5 ships in the convoy going over. And we just saw them going down, you know, on the horizon away from us, and just hear the bang and the smoke going, the flames, and that was it.
Did you lose any of the battalion through that action?
We never lost any off our boat, no, none of us, no. We're all on the one boat, and we got through safely into Valletta Harbour.
What did that look like as you drew in?
The place looked a shambles. It looked all right from a couple of miles out till you get closer, like, and then you saw where all the buildings had been demolished, you know, really heavily bombed. And then we got in there, into Valletta. We moved up to the north part of the island to a place called Rabat. And it was the place of the governor's residence at that time, in peacetime. And we went under canvas into the grounds there. They were all under trees. Of course, you had to be all camouflaged. And we were there for about 3 or 4 days, and we went down to this other place, and a place called Dingley Dale, and the north part of the island. And when we got there, we put it into tents and that, and went on different duties on the coast, and
what kind of jobs were you doing?
Mostly coastal patrols, watching out for enemy submarines, airplanes coming in, giving warning, and of course the RAF. I mean, what we had with the RAF then, they knew exactly where we were coming from. We were coming mainly from Cyprus and all them places, like, you know, Sicily. Sicily was the main place. The German Stukas, Dorniers, what have you, Messerschmitts, the whole lot.
Were you severely bombed yourselves?
Very severely bombed, yes. And that was... used to get about 3 or 4 raids a day. And we seen 200 or 300 planes at a time coming over. Well, there was nothing you'd do. Well, and our duties were... to travel from where we were, the north part of the island, go down to Hellfire Aerodrome and help the engineers. And we're building fortifications on the aerodrome for the shelter of the Spitfires. There was no Spitfires in that time. It was just the three gladiators. In fact, they were called Faith, Hope and Charity. And... couple of Blenheim bombers and things like that, but anyway, they knew the Spitfires were coming in later, and building these shelters out of petrol tins. We used to fill and pull the sand, take a top off without bayonets, slice the tops off, fill and pull the sand, and just hand them over one to each other, and build these big fortifications about 18 to 20 foot high, and they used to be about 4 petrol cans wide, and just build them all up. And they used to be great big hangars, and just room for the Spitfire to be put in, and maybe about 2 foot each side for the wings, you know, to come in and out safely. Used to give them protection from the German bombers, like on 3 parts, and that would be a direct hit or one immediately in front of it, you know, to damage the plane.
What time would your day start?
Your day started away from Rivoli. Well, it was no Rivoli sounded like, but away from Stanton in the morning, away from 5 o'clock at least. And you used to get out of the airdrome, and you used to stop down there till about 6 o'clock at night. And then you used to come back up and you got your meals and that when you got back up to your base camp, like, you know, where we were.
You hadn't been long out of Tobruk. What was your health like, having lived under such sparse rations for so long?
Well, there was none of us suffering from any sort of ill health, really. No, not really.
How did the Maltese receive you?
Oh, welcome. All they really gave us a good welcome, yes. They really looked after us. And we used to give them anything we had. If we got a bar of chocolate or English cigarettes like that, you know, we used to get that in exchange for bread and that of them. But mind, rations, things, they were very tight at the finish. We used to go down to an old baker's in a place called Ingiwani Street. There was a baker's there in Rabat. And we used to get what called a noggin of bread then, off them, in exchange for a few cigarettes and, you know, and tomatoes.
Once again, you were in a severely rationed situation.
Oh, yes. You couldn't get any, couldn't eat exactly what you wanted. No.
Were you hungry most of the time?
Not really hungry, no. Well, we so used to space rations, you know, which were broken, not too well, it wasn't affecting us so much, really. No.
Did you lose any men through the bombing raids and so forth?
Oh, yes, you lost a few men through the bombings, aye. Especially through them personal mines that our trolleys used to drop.
What exactly were these?
They were like the old-fashioned Craven 18, the round Craven 18, we used to get the cigarettes in. They were shaped like that. We used to get 50 cigarettes in. And you used to drop them, you used to shovel them out, I think, and just drop them anywhere. And of course, they were personal bombs, and you had to be very careful with them. And what we used to do, we used to get them, we used to let them lie for about 10 or 12 hours, and then we knew they weren't going to go up. Then we used to pick them up all careful, like, you know, load them all up and just dump them into the sea. Because we were right near the coast where we were.
So you were working on the airfield, as you said, and then on coastal defence as well.
Yeah.
What was the discipline like on the island?
Oh, it was good discipline, yes. The discipline was very good. And then when the convoys used to come in, if, say, three boats got in out of about 20, we used to go down to the docks and unload them. And, of course, all the bombings were going on all the time while they were unloading. And we used to take no notice of the finish. You got one very close, you got your head down sort of style. But you had to get the boat cleared and unloaded that same day so it could sail on the next tide. And because you should lift the boom in the harbour at night time once. Only once in every 24 hours you should lift the boom to let the ships out or any submarines or any of our craft in for repairs.
So it would have to be done very quick.
Everything was done very quickly, all done at night time, within about 4 hours.
Did you see some of the ships coming in that had obviously suffered from enemy attacks?
Oh, yes, we saw the ships coming in while they were limping in.
Was there an admiration for the Maltese and what they were suffering amongst you?
Oh, yes. We knew what they were going through. I mean, because they were really in the thick of it. I mean, it was their towns and houses getting all smashed to pieces. Of course, they were moving from one part of the island, you know, from where the heavy bombing was, to other parts of the island while the bombing lasted. And then when it all finished, they just went back and started rebuilding. You couldn't. And our mode of transport then was from where we were, Rabat, what cycles. And each one of us had a cycle, and we had a ride down there, and you just had your rifle, your bayonet, because you were using a bayonet to open the petrol tins when you got down there, and luckily there was a cemetery right next to the aerodrome, and when the German bombers used to come over, we used to dive into the cemetery. Well, there was always a lot of open graves there, and we were diving in there using the slit trenches. Nighttime.
These were open to receive civilian or whatever
casualties? Civilian, aye, aye.